Hello and welcome back to the Mojo Podcast and the last episode of this third series, which has been all about Mojo and sporting endeavour. I really hope you've been inspired, entertained and found some pearls of wisdom in here. I've been blessed to have found and been introduced to 10 incredible guests, all with their own take on Mojo, their unique stories of ups and downs in and around sport, and crucially, the lessons they have learned along the way. And then the generosity they've had to share those stories with me and all of you. So thank you to my guests. This week, just a superb guest to close the series. And it's really appropriate to be talking about the end of one thing and the beginning of something new, about change and transition.
I found myself after having retired or being forced to retire because of injury, I would introduce myself. And if people said, oh, hi, like, what's your name or whatever? What's your name? What do you do? I'd be like, oh, hi, I'm Ollie. I used to play rugby because it was who I am. It was everything about me, right? I was Ollie, the rugby player. I was Ollie, the Stade Francais player, Ollie, the England captain, Ollie, the best player in the world, whatever it was. But I was that. That was me. I lived and breathed that because from the age of four, I'd become institutionalized in being a professional athlete.
This week, my guest is Ollie Phillips, former England rugby international, global adventurer, entrepreneur and businessman, sports journalist and commentator. And those are just a few of Ollie's achievements and identities. There is much more as we discuss, such as sailing around the world, cycling across America, and leading the world's most northerly game of rugby at the North Pole. He's a busy guy and a fabulous guest. You know, it's funny, but when I sit and edit these podcasts and listen back to what my guests have shared in the moment, so much more becomes obvious to me. Of course, I listen deeply and I try to create the environment for a flowing conversation, but it's when I listen back, I get the fuller picture. Often not the story I perhaps expected to emerge, but a deeper one. And in Ollie's case, a really honest personal examination of just how tough it was to go from the high stakes, instant feedback, huge adulation environment of professional sport into the world of business. And in those tough times, what became clear is that Ollie has done the work on himself to make sense of who he is and what and who he wants to be. And to be able to reflect back on that glittering career in rugby that now helps him coach the rugby stars of the future in a better way. He also takes his learning and experience from sport and moves it into the business world to help corporates and people who work there better understand their own potential and how to reach it. So you're going to love this one, so I'm not going to delay you getting to the brilliant conversation. All about the power of shared experiences, transitioning, identity, what drives us, parenting, and what it means to have an attitude of gratitude. If you're a regular listener, you'll know how much I value feedback for this podcast, so please do hop over to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star rating. That takes just one click. And if you have 30 seconds, please do write a short review too. Those reviews really matter and make all the difference in new listeners being able to discover the Mojo Podcast and allow them the powerful shared experience of hearing from amazing guests like Ollie. And if you like this one, hey, there are 9 other amazing conversations in this series, so go and give those a listen too. So thanks for listening, thanks for the feedback, and thanks for thinking about your mojo. Now, over to my conversation with Ollie Phillips. Welcome back to the Mojo Podcast, and I'm delighted for this episode. We're back in the UK, we're on the outskirts of London, in Henley, and I have Ollie Phillips with me today. Ollie, how are you doing?
I'm wonderful, thanks, Richard. Great to be here, and delighted that it's finally sun shining and summer is coming.
Well, we're going to talk about optimism, but I dare say there's grounds for optimism with the weather that the UK especially has been seeing recently. So, on that feeling wonderful, I love to do this. I love to check in on people's mojo number. So out of 10, where would your mojo be today, Ollie?
Mojo's definitely high today. It's a good day today. I would say I'm kicking at the sort of high 8s, 9s. I mean, we could even push the boundaries to a 10 out of 10, but there's always room for improvement. So let's go for the 9s.
A Let's go for a 9. Okay. And so that improvement, to stretch that 9 to a 10, what would it have to be for you to go, yeah, it's a 10 out of 10?
It's like the winning lottery ticket comes in, doesn't it? I mean, doesn't necessarily be money, but just a total game changer day that, what would be the extra 1%? I would love that all goes smoothly for this, my next adventure that I've got coming up, which is in Ireland in July, because it's still touch and go as to what the rules and regs are in Ireland. So the extra one would be that everyone's fine. All 40 of us can go cycle around Ireland as part of a epic adventure.
Oh, right. So that's the next epic adventure. Okay. I'm sure we'll touch on that, because, I mean, one of the many reasons we're talking today is a litany of epic adventures that you've been on, and I want to get into some of those. Just before I do, so that we found, you know, your mojo high today, 9 out of 10. Yes. What it might take, you know, that little extra to stretch it to a 10. So when I say mojo and ask you about it, what does that mean to you personally?
Your general mood set, your mindset, how you're approaching your day, how you're feeling about life, how people around you are impacting on you and influencing your sort of trajectory, whether, you know, whether life's on course, off course, all of that sort of stuff for me plays into my sort of overall mojo, which is how do I present myself every day in every single environment.
So it's kind of how you're showing up every day. Yeah. in what you're doing.
Yeah, for me, that's what it means.
Mm, yeah, lovely. And you know, and that's why I ask, it's a very personal thing, I think, to different people. And look, you know, I obviously research my guests before we meet up. And I was looking at your LinkedIn profile, and you talked about how I show up in whatever guise. And as I said to you on the phone before, I'm not sure I've seen a more full, longer LinkedIn profile of someone of your kind of age. There's a lot.
Just put it all in there. Just chuck it all on there.
There's a lot of stuff in there that you've done in the world of sport, in the world of adventure, in business, being an entrepreneur, being a journalist and commentator. So I'm just wondering what that, you know, you've done an awful lot at this point in your life. I'm sure there's loads more to come. But does that help your mojo, having that kind of behind you?
I mean, it's a great question. Yes, ultimately, I would say, because you take confidence from experience, right? I think if you've been there, done something, it's never as scary as it is at the start, right? But I think, you know, I'm not, out of all those things you've mentioned, I've never, you know, I've never been the best or anything like that. It's never always been about that. It's just been about excelling and fulfilling my own potential, right? So my own interest and my own capability and my own potential in that environment. And I would say that's evolved over time, because at the beginning, in my younger years, if you like, my late teens, early 20s, I was sort of obsessed by me and becoming, you know, the best athlete and winning all the competitions and da da da, and it was all centered around that. And actually, if I were to reflect on that now, having, you know, been late 30s now, yeah, the best things that have happened to me in my life have been all through shared experience. And actually, the end results were sort of positive, but there could always have been more, and it could always have been better. It could always have been worse, but I'm quite happy and content with where it all ended up, kind of thing. So yes, I'm driven. Yes, I like the sort of success factor, but it's become less and less about the outcome. Life's all about stories and all about shared experience. I mean, even our example as a, you know, a tripe one, I will always remember my first call with Richard Stokes, where he was sat on a beach in Ibiza with blue skies behind him as it was raining outside, right? So I know that's a trivial tripe example, right? But that is, I'm never going to remember the piece of equipment that I rang you on, or I will remember the moment, the shared experience. And for 10 years down, it will still be, do you remember that time you ran me on a beach, you git, and you were sat in a pastel colored top and it was like life was glorious? Like, you know, that's the beauty of shared experience and shared memories of a particular moment in time.
You sort of reflected back to being, you know, the younger you versus now, and I guess that's when your relationship with sport was probably getting quite serious. When was that the time? And you'd say yourself, I was very driven, quite egocentric, as we said, but
When was that moment where you knew actually being an elite athlete, being a professional athlete, that could happen?
I think you start to get a feel of it, you know, or at least a hope, an inkling around you're 15, 16, when you start to play. Well, one of my caps behind me is actually one of my sort of England students cap on there. But, you know, you start to sort of understand England under 16s, England under 18s. You're playing in this environment. You're playing for your county. It's all about this sort of achievement and recognition. You play for your school, you play for your county, you play for your division, you play for north south of England, then you play for your country, you know, and then you play in a World Cup and all the rest of it. So you go through this through the youth setup where, you know, you're already getting exposure to these highly competitive environments, but equally these amazing life experiences with a shared group of people. So that already you already start to get the bug and the appetite to be part of that, to continue on that journey or that experience. And then professionalism rolls into that as you hit sort of 18, 19, 20. And fortunately, it's becoming less and less now in rugby, I'm seeing, but fortunately at the time when I was playing, there was the opportunity to still, you know, maintain university and academic, I guess, foundations so that you could set yourself up with something. Whereas I'm seeing more and more players now straight out of school, 17, 18, they're in that professional environment just because of how competitive it's got now and how cutthroat it is. And ultimately, you know, money's driven that as well.
So it's kind of a different era now in terms
yeah,
of
definitely.
Sport develops. But the sport you chose to excel at or were naturally drawn to was a team sport, back to your point about shared experiences. And it sounds like that was maybe a big driver of it for you. Is that the case?
Yeah, I mean, I've actually done a load of work in terms of what was sort of fueling, if you like, that ego, for want of a better description, but my drivers all the way through. So, and certainly for me, there was a high dependency and need for team environment, but that also stemmed from this need for recognition, reward, encouragement, support from others, validation from others. And a sporting environment is, if they're some of your sort of whatever, you know, weaknesses, tells that you need, right? A sporting environment is perfect because you've got one or two coaches that basically pick you or don't pick you each week. You've got a crowd of people, be it 10,000, 80,000, 50 people, that's, you know, at the end of it, tell you whether you're great or not great. And then you've got a group of teammates that sort of either love you or loathe you. And that as an environment for a personality like me that was seeking those sorts of things was, I've never done a drug in my life, but I would liken it to being a drug addict, right? That would be my fix.
Right. Getting that external validation from these either key people immediately around you or that wider community of fans. Is that super instant feedback?
Yeah.
On whatever you've done?
On them every day, every single day, whether that be in training where a coach is like, brilliant, absolutely excellent, or, you know, the team, you overcome something, to then match day, 80,000 people, 10,000 people, whatever it is that's in the stadium. And then because of the nature of sport, you get to do it every week, right? And that roller coaster just keeps on rolling. And if it's good, it's great. And if it's bad, it's terrible. And, you know, that those highs and lows are, you know, infectious. And yeah, I think it was, I wasn't clued in when I was playing as to what my drivers were. I was just obsessed with being the best. And it was only when I left and transitioned out of the sport that I was like, and there was this huge, obviously, void in my life, that suddenly I was like, oh my God, like, why do I feel this way? And what's going on? And I suddenly started to, you know, do a bit of digging and realizing, wow, okay, you know, there's more to me than I realized, and it was more sort of complicated or complex than I appreciated.
Yeah. So let's talk about that, because one of the themes I wanted to talk about was transition from, you know, elite athlete, as you say, playing at the absolute highest levels of the game, in terms of the 15s version, the 7s version of the game, you know, playing for England, captaining England. And then all that you talked about, the adulation, the feedback, the adrenaline, you know, almost like drug-like that you talked about, to then you're not playing. So how do you get your head around that? What did you need to do?
Yeah, I think this is the, you know, this conversation is that the hardest for, I guess, people that aren't involved in the environment to understand. And then equally, the, I guess, the conversation that those that are involved in the environment would like to try and ignore or avoid in chatting around, because ultimately it's the end of the adventure. And if you're sitting on the outside, if you like, it's a roller coaster ride that you're desperate, that you would love to be on. Like, most people would love to have the opportunity to play professional sport, represent their country and everything else like that. So you kind of have to walk that little tightrope when you talk around it, of like, I don't want to seem ungrateful or like it wasn't something I wanted to do. But equally, there is still a fall off. Like, there is still a, you know, cliff edge that you come to. And, you know, emotionally, I think it's very difficult to prepare yourself for that, because to your point, you grow up for a long, you know, bear in mind, I started playing rugby when I was 4. So those things that you don't really appreciate, but those emotional cues of like every weekend you play for your mini rugby club and you're like, you know, the best kid running around and you're doing this and you're doing that. All of that obviously starts to build and maybe layer on and mask over some of the, I don't know, insecurities that you might have as a little one. Like, giving my parents divorced at when I was 10, 11. So as a result of that, you know, that left of, you know, I didn't appreciate any of this at the time, but you know, that left a void at home in terms of someone to look up to and get recognition and reward of and be told I was good and they're proud of and all that sort of stuff, that then rugby became the avenue through which I got all that fulfillment. So then you go through that, you progress all your life, you get a contract, you then play for your club, you play in the European Cups and you get picked for England and you get picked to captain England. And then I was fortunate, I got voted as the best player in the world. So all of these things just build and build and build. And as a rugby player or a sports person, whatever, you are a specialist, right? You are used to being a specialist. Like, if I use rugby as the analogy, I was a winger. I was a specialist at, give me the ball, I'm fast, I can finish tries. Equally, someone that's a specialist prop is like, give them the opportunity to bend down, go shoulder to shoulder to someone else, and I'll destroy them in a scrum or whatever else. So everyone's got an area of specialism, and you work and you refine that area of specialism to the point where you are the top one percentile in the world of people that can play rugby. Right, you're the best of an elite crop of people. And then when that stops, when the curtain comes down, and you're like, okay, thanks very much, off you go into like the working world, everyone that you've been, all your peer group, all your friends and everything else around you that are outside of rugby, they've obviously done 12 years in industry. Like, most people are coming out at, you know, 32 to 35, unless you get injured and it's a bit earlier. But your peer group around you, they've worked for 12 years, hard slog in whatever they're doing, and now they're specialists in their specialist area. So they've got an area of specialism. You're coming out with new responsibilities. Some people are married, kids, whatever. You're used to a certain lifestyle, et cetera, et cetera. And then you're walking into a working environment where actually your new role is as a generalist. And you're like, well, hold on, no, give me the ball. Like, give me the ball. I can, you know, to use that as this sort of, to try and contextualize it. It's like, no, I want to dot I's, I want to cross T's. That's what, you know, I'm used to being the expert in this arena. And then you've obviously got all the other bits of, I guess, your insecurities coming in of like, I'm used to being an authority and credible and accountable in my job and my function. And yet here I am in this new environment where I'm, yeah, maybe in a role of responsibility, but really I haven't got a clue what's going on. I haven't got a clue. How can I make decisions around stuff like, you know, I don't know. I don't know to use the rugby analogy, like, I've been on the field for 20 years. Like, I know what good looks like. I know what bad looks like. I can call bullshit. I can, you know, I can play the game. And equally, I've got an area of specialism in the game, but I can also understand everybody else's role and function, like, not to the same degree that they can, but I can at least still commentate on the game. Yeah. Whereas in my new environment, whatever, mine was PwC, but whatever else that, you know, whatever it is for anyone else, it's like, well, what's this? What game is this? I don't understand this game. And how can I be a specialist in this? And who here is going to tell me I'm great? And, you know, the other good thing about sport was you got immediate feedback, as you said, 80 minutes at the end of it, I've won or lost. Okay, brilliant. Dust your hands off, turn up on Monday, let's process what we did right, process what we did wrong, let's have another go at it on Saturday. Whereas in the working world, you could be like, right, let's let's go and make this investment decision, or let's go left, let's go right, and then let's wait for 3 years to see whether it worked. The transition emotionally, mentally, psychologically, physically, is huge. You know, you're in the physically, you're in the best shape of your life, the fittest you've ever been, the strongest you've ever been. I mean, you are never going to look like you look like in a pair of, you know, budgie smugglers or a pair of swim shorts. And I can see, you know, a lot of people might listen and go, yeah, you know, pass me the violin, mate. You know, like it's, you know, it's, but I'm not asking for pity, or I'm just sort of trying to sort of articulate what the emotional transition is about and what it's like.
Completely. And you know, this series, I've been talking to a lot of current athletes, and lots with a bit of an eye on the future. And one of the things we talked about is that sense that when athletes are on the field, we kind of, as the public, we just see them in this way of being, you know, you're obviously invincible, you're an athlete, you're there in the uniform. And we don't necessarily think about them as the human being, not nearly enough. And I think what you're talking very eloquently there about that transition is, I've always been a human being, just I was doing this role, and now I'm taking on this one. And guess what? It's not easy. And how could it be easy? And how could it be easy?
Yeah, 100%. And equally, you know, to add to that, it's I'm now doing this role, and my whole identity, if you like, for the from my adolescence all the way through to my adulthood, has been shaped, formed, molded, and ultimately underpinned by my role as a sports person. So, you know, I found myself after having retired or being forced to retire because of injury, I would introduce myself. And if people said, oh, hi, like, what's your name or whatever? What's your name? What do you do? I'd be like, oh, hi, I'm Ollie. I used to play rugby because it was who I am. It was, yeah, it was everything about me, right? Yeah. I was Ollie, the rugby player. I was Ollie, the, you know, Stade Francais player, Ollie, the England captain, Ollie, the best player in the world, whatever it was. But that, I was that. That was me. I lived and breathed that because, you know, from the age of four, I'd become just engrossed and institutionalized in being a professional athlete.
Yeah. So how that point on identity, how did you start to sort of grab that back and come back to, as you said, you've done a lot of work, you know, post coming out of rugby, about who you are, and what you're about?
Well, I think it was, you know, well, I know it was because my behavior in my day-to-day life at that point started to become destructive for me, and for, you know, me personally, and for other people that were important in my life, that, and equally that in my behavior wasn't a fair representation of, like, ultimately who I wanted to be, the values that I sort of stood by, and, if you like, you know, my epitaph when I die, like, they were, my behaviors were not the things that I wanted to be remembered by and referred to. So I'd become a destructive force, if that makes sense. And as a result of that, I reached out for help. And luckily there were people around me, if you like, through the RPA, which is our Rugby Players Union and whatever else, that could help connect me up to the right people that were, you know, it was a company called Cognasti. So, like, a, you know, counselor or therapist, whatever you want to call them, that, ultimately, for me, it was my savior, that I could just sit there and say, like, look, this is what's going on in my head. Like, this is what's happening. I don't understand it. And initially, you know, that process takes a long time, because initially when I turned up, I treated it ultimately as, like, almost as rehab. As like, oh, like, I walk into the physio, I broke my arm. Like, tell me what I need to do. Like, how many exercises do I need to do? And you'll tell me 100, I'll go and do 200. And then you'll tell me I'll be back in 3 months. I'll make sure I'm back in two, and it'll all be fixed. And right. I can walk. Right. But yeah, it doesn't work like that. It's so that was another piece of the puzzle, which is like, okay, this isn't a, you tell me how high to jump and I'll jump higher. This is, Ollie, you need to talk down. You need to tell me what's going on. And then as you talk, I'm going to ask you some challenging questions that are going to enable you to, if you like, realize what is happening in your world, and what your triggers are, what your tells are, and ultimately what these things are that determine and drive your own behavior. And then you're going to get control of them, and then you're going to move forward in a positive way.
Wow. So, all, as you said, all that look, you're then able to look back on, so this is why I've been in rugby, attracted me so much. This is why it's so important. And as you say, that's the looking back bit. And now, right, looking forward, what do I choose to be?
Yeah, what do I choose to be, and what are my tells? What brings on some of these destructive behaviors? So, so you can start to appreciate and manage and control them a little bit better. Who do I, you know, then moving forward, like, who do I want to be? How do I want to behave? And then start to you know, design that, right? Be the architect of your own success and future. But I mean, that took a long time. It took me, what, 18 months to get that, to go through that process. So, yeah, it was, and it was really challenging. Definitely. It was one of the hardest things I emotionally and mentally had gone through. Definitely. But it was worth it.
Mm. And that, you know, that lovely phrase you used there about being the architect of your own life. What is it you decided then? Right. You know, this is Ollie 2.0. What is it I want now from life?
Yeah, I think, well, it comes down to some of those things we spoke around originally, which was, I had a very clear picture in my mind as to, like, the person that I wanted to be, like, how I wanted to behave, how I wanted to interact with those people around me that I, you know, loved and cared about, how I could ultimately show my compassion, love, care, or whatever for them all. And then equally from a, I guess, professional perspective, actually, I mean, in my rugby career, I make it sound, you know, a bit bad. It wasn't all the ego, right? But certainly at the beginnings, it was all driven by my own drivers. And now I'm much more focused on, actually, it's an experience that I'm after. Like, I'm after a shared experience. So, you know, I still want to be successful, but equally, I just want the shared experience. So if we go to climb a mountain together, this is an extreme example, and we don't get to the top, I'm fine with it. Whereas before, I could never have dealt with it. I could never, ever, right, ever have dealt with it. I'd have probably just kept going until I'd have killed myself, because it was, you know, the weather was too. Whereas now it's about, I still want to get to the top. I still want to make it happen. I'm still fairly dogged and determined, but that's not the number one driver. That's not the number one priority. It's about, actually, Rich, like, what, like, I'm here to have this experience with you, and wow, look at this view, and how are you getting on, and how are we managing through this, and how are we collectively dealing with adversity and challenge or whatever. And I take loads of enthusiasm and encouragement and positives out of that, rather than, well, look at me, I'm still at the top of the mountain.
Yeah, wow. So that's what I wanted to talk a bit about, because a lot of the adventures, the challenges that you've completed since coming out of professional rugby take a huge amount of drive. But it sounds like in that drive, there is this almost, I don't know, is a responsibility within it as well. It's not, I must reach for the sake of, it's, I'd like to do this, and I've got the drive to do it myself, but I also want to bring some people with me.
That's what it is for me now. If I think my over, you know, if I were, you know, when I speak to, you know, fellow professionals or whatever else, or just people, actually, forget like sports people, but I just try and ask them to like fully understand and appreciate their drivers. I mean, Simon Sinek calls, you know, it's been coined all over the place, but, you know, obviously your why, like just really understanding like why it is important to you, and ultimately what fulfillment you get out of this. And then just sense checking that is actually aligned to who you are and what you want to be and everything else that you've kind of sort of set your precedent out as to who Ollie Phillips or Richard Stokes, you know, wants to be remembered by. And if that's consistent, obviously go get it. I mean, go after it, be dogged, be determined, be driven, be focused. Mm. Of course, I'm not saying like be apathetic and don't pursue anything and just give up on, no, that's not what I'm saying. But if you like, I was immensely driven. In all honesty, maybe I could have taken even, I took a lot of enjoyment, but maybe I could have taken even more enjoyment and fulfillment out of my professional rugby career if I had been really in tune with my drivers, which, like, in all honesty, like, I wasn't. I was just going at it hammer and tong because I thought being the best in the world was what I wanted to be. Like, I want to be the best. I want to beat everybody. Mm. Da, 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 da. And actually, that wasn't really what I wanted to be. And that was all being driven by this actual need, which was like, oh, if I am the best in the world, and if I do beat everybody, everybody thinks I'm amazing, and then everybody gives me praise, everybody gives me recognition. And I don't really want to talk about like my parents' divorce, or like, you know, or, you know, how my relationship with my old man or whatever else. So I'll just be ignorant to all that sort of stuff, bury it. And I was totally desensitized to it. So I wasn't even aware of it, if that makes sense. But you know, I'll just keep going for this stuff, which flash in the pan makes me feel really good.
I was going to say, because you're now, and one of the many things we're doing, you're coaching rugby, the Welsh women's sevens team. If
yes.
I'm not wrong. Yeah. Okay. So my question is, so that the drive that you had, and you know, very single-minded in competitive sport, how do you see the balance then between, I guess, old Ollie and Ollie you are now, if you were to be able to play sport at the highest levels and be competitive and win, but do it in that, as you say, that mindset of, you know, it's okay if I don't win or I don't play my best, it's all right, that's enough. Does that make sense, that question?
Yeah. I still think I'm, you know, it's, if I see in my coaching style and whatever else now with you know, I do one-on-one executive coaching and I'm head coach for Wales Women, right? And all of that is fueled by, you know, me wanting to help people achieve the best versions of themselves that they possibly can be. So I think it's, maybe this is the way the miscommunication sometimes comes in, right? But it's not about being driven, because I think aspiring to be successful, aspiring to achieve things is part of life, right? It's part of the fun of the whole experience of like, wow, okay, I wanted to do something, I set a goal out, and wow, I've achieved it. Like, that's really respectable and that's really incredible thing to do. But what you find is a lot of people get to that goal and it's a quite hollow existence, because they haven't really understood
why
it's really important. And I mean, the classic adage is, you see all these people that like want to be a millionaire, they get to be a millionaire, then they want to be a multimillionaire because they think, well, maybe that's not enough money, I'll just keep going and get more money. Yeah. And at the end of it, they've got, you know, 15 houses, 3 boats sitting on it, and they're on their third wife or husband, their kids don't talk to them anymore, and they've realized, actually, I don't know what it was all about in the first place, right? They've had a total disconnect from what their driver was and why it was important. So it's just making sure that you've got clarity around why this gives you fulfillment and what's so important about it. And that's what I try and encourage a lot of my, you know, coaches and players and whatever else, which is around, look, you know, we're going to set these goals and whatever they might be, win this game, win a World Cup, whatever else, because they're aspirational, because they give us focus, they give us, you know, drive and determination, and they're going to make us all feel really good, right? It's a nice thing to be victorious and having success, in inverted commas. But the real success is going to come from understanding and tuning into why that's really important to you, and actually loving and relishing in this privileged moment that you're in, and all the people around you and the friends that you're going to make. And like, don't lose sight of all of that, because that's actually what's going to stay with you forever. Your World Cup medal will sit on a wall, and just like my caps on the wall and whatever else, like, they sit there and collect dust. So it's not about that. It's about that shared experience and about the memory.
And, you know, amazing perspective you've got, because you've been through it, you've lived it, and you can play that back to, you know, especially the people in sport you're coaching, because you hear it a lot, don't you, about people fulfill that, you know, the ambition, I've won this league or that cup. And then there is that emptiness. I think, you know, Johnny Wilkinson, classic example of that in terms of post 2003 World Cup. And, you know, his levels of depression got deeper and deeper after that. But how can, you know, thinking about the world of sport now, how can we help, is it, you know, younger people coming through sport with that understanding then? Of, as you say, success is actually being the best version of yourself, not necessarily it's got to be that label.
And I think that's the important part, right? I think it's just making sure that as young kids come up and go through, you know, systems or teams or whatever else, and they've got aspirations, that they've got goals, that, you know, it's the classic, right? But it's not the overbearing parent that just wants little Johnny or whatever else to be everything that they couldn't be, right?
Mm.
Because at the end of it all, little Johnny comes out the end of the whole experience thinking, well, when they hit a level of maturity, going, well, I don't know what this was all about in the first place. I don't know why it was important to me. And actually, all I was ever doing was trying to make my dad happy and or my mum happy or, you know, whatever else, whatever that story is, right? But just trying to encourage, I've got two young kids of my own, 3 and 1, just mm-hmm. trying to encourage them to do and be whoever they want to be, like, and be comfortable within that. And actually, as a, you know, as a parent, as a coach or whatever else, you know, your role is to, it's just to provide different pictures, right? Just give them exposure to as many different opportunities as possible so that they can paint their own, they can determine their own direction of travel. And you'll, as a parent, you'll take great confidence and satisfaction in the fact that you've helped steer your daughter or your son in the direction that they know gives them fulfillment. And that, for me as a parent, for example, is the only thing that would make me really happy, would be knowing my kids are, they feel valued, they know what they want in life, they're super enthusiastic, they wake up every day with a smile, and yeah, that's what it's all about. Like, and I think you can get lost in that, like, no, I'm just going to be hard on them and make them work hard. Of course you need to instill like good habits and behaviors in people, right? But just make sure it's not all becoming about you and your life vision and what you want for them. Because what you want for them might not be what they want for themselves.
And that's it. And as you know, as a new dad as well myself, it resonates a lot about, you know, having the awareness of in yourself to know whose dreams and ambitions are these that I'm talking about to my son.
Exactly. Yeah.
I don't want to, I'm not going to force this on him. And it seems to me that you know, the parental responsibility in that is to have the awareness of yourself to go, who is this for? I'm dragging you to rugby or football training on this wet Sunday when actually you prefer to be at home playing your guitar or doing some art, whatever it might be. As you say, whatever fulfills that child's personal potential and ambition and makes them happy. Yeah,
that is the greatest coaching responsibility in the world, right? I mean, it's forever that role as a coach, you know, that one as a parent. And you know, I think, you know, the more support everyone can give to each other and the more IP knowledge we can all share around stuff that, you know, happens and how we can give each other greater exposure, the better, right? Because no one's ever born to be a great parent, right? It's not, there's not a handbook, there's not a manual, you know, loads of people have written books about it, but like, there's no like set way of like parenting. You just feel it out as you go, right? So but you learn and you adapt. But the critical part, as you said, is making sure that it doesn't become about you and your story. It's got to be about them and their story. And you just try and support them and give them as much color in their life as possible. And you just, obviously there are going to be moments where you know, you push them a little bit just to help them experience and realize that actually they can do this stuff, that, you know, they can over. I had this with my daughter, like, the other week, like, she was on a diving board and she didn't want to jump off, and part of me was like, well, why wouldn't she jump off? Of course she's gonna jump off, just jump, just come on, you'll be fine, like that. And then I had to like, well, stand back, Ollie, you're 38 years of age, of course you've been there, done it, you know you can, so don't force her into doing something because she's gonna hate it and whatever else. Just encourage her, demonstrate, like, so I jumped off it a few times, and then lo and behold, like half an hour later she ran, jumped off in the pool, and I was like awesome, amazing. Whereas I could have been like that oppressive dad that she starts crying, and that, you know, the thought process of jumping off of diving board suddenly becomes a nightmare for her, which is a, you know, car crash on all fronts. So but it's a fine line, right? I mean, I'm certain this is probably, it's a tripe trivial example, but you know, all these things are minutiae bits that build into bigger pictures.
I was
going
to say, it all builds up, and it could, you know, that could be a, I don't know, X years later, why isn't you don't like jumping off diving boards? Well,
I'm scared of heights because it's
with my dad a while ago.
Yeah.
But slight change of gears, because I did want to touch on some of your amazing adventures. And actually, I'm going to link it to your kids as well. So you've done, you know, incredible adventures around the world, top of the world. You've been there, done it. So I wanted to ask you, you know, when your kids come to you
I don't know, maybe it's when they're sort of in their teenage years, and they say, "So, Dad, so what have you, of the amazing things you did when I was before I was around, or when I was very little, what one did you learn the most about yourself from?"
I would say to them two, but that's cheating.
That's allowed. We can do two.
So that's the dad. I'll say, look, I'm going to give you two because I'm your dad. But I would say the sailing around the world, because it came at a time in my life at the end of my playing career. It turned out that was the biggest stroke of luck ever, going as part of that, because my entire life direction was ultimately aided, dictated, determined by me doing that race.
Wow. Okay.
And it opened my eyes up to actually a different way of leading, if you like. And I thought leadership was all around having captaining, like shout the loudest, run the hardest, be the fittest, etc. All this stuff we've already spoken around, and going out on this boat with, you know, people from the ages of like 19 to 75, and their drivers were nothing to do with winning necessarily. Now, they wanted to have life experiences, sail around the world, see the oceans, sprinkle the ashes of their loved ones in the ocean, whatever, right? So all these different drivers, and suddenly made me realize, actually, the only way that you can really advance, influence, you know, coach and achieve my goals, aspirational goals with a collective group of people, is by tuning into what makes them move and really understanding their value set. So that's was undoubtedly a massive game changer for me. And then the other one, which I would still rank as my greatest adventure ever, was when I cycled across America with my wife. Well, who she wasn't my wife at that point, but with my girlfriend, who is now my wife and obviously the mother to our two and soon to be three amazing kids. That for me was a game changer, because if you like, all of my life, as I'd mentioned to you, was always about shinier pennies, right? And getting recognition and love from, and that resonated across everything. So that was sport, that was finance, that was relationships. You know, I was never, you know, that's what I'm talking around behaviors, right? I was always just wanting more. So I just want more money, or want a better girlfriend, or want to, like, just never really appreciating and loving the moment and the person and actually the partnership and all the rest of it, right? And when I cycled across America, it was the first time ever that I was like, I don't know what the word is, content, or like, I don't need anything else, if that makes sense. I don't need anything or anyone else. So that was probably why that was the biggest moment.
And what was it? It was doing something, you know, a very, very tough shared experience again. I guess we're back to that. Was it about going through, I guess, some, like you used the word before, ups and downs, highs and lows on that adventure? Was that part of it?
Well, to a certain degree, yes. But I'll be honest, there weren't many lows. Like, I think even like the down bits were still made in a sort of sycophantic way, but like quite enjoyable. Like, because it was like, well, I don't know, traditionally when I've had this sort of down bit, it would be all disaster and everyone would kick off and, you know, she'd go mens at me or I'd go mens at her, like blah, blah, blah. Whereas I was like, I'm just loving the fact that, okay, this is a bit of a crappy scenario, but actually we're dealing with this and it's actually really enjoyable dealing with it. It's quite hard to sort of articulate. So I think, yes, there was an element of that, but I just think it was one of the very first times, if you like, in my life, that I was just present. Like, and it sounds a bit sort of like spiritual, whatever, but, and I'm not that spiritual, but I was just in it and really enjoying it for it and for what it was and loving every moment, rather than like, what's next and how can I make this better? Or how can I get, you know, how can I get the shinier penny in this scenario? And I just wasn't looking for that. I didn't need that. I didn't feel the need for that. I was just totally happy with where I was, if that makes sense. And yeah. And I knew at that point that she was ultimately that was an amazing experience, and ultimately that woman was going to be my wife, because I never had that experience before.
Amazing.
It's deep, Rich. It's deep for a Thursday.
I love that on a Thursday. What a way to just you know, solidify a relationship, cycle across America.
Yeah. Or break one or the other. But yes, I mean, it was...
to find out, anyway, to understand. And Ollie, just to sort of, as we sort of get towards the end of the episode, what I like to do is check in with people about daily habits, routines, almost the non-negotiables of life that you've got to have in your day for your mojo. You know, we check in today, it was a 9 out of 10. Yeah, to be as high as possible, what are the things that you need to do every day?
I need to exercise. That's one of the things I have to, you know, I really have to do. Like, I think it's just because it's institutionalized in me. I find if I kickstart my day off by doing some form of getting my, you know, getting the adrenaline going and getting my body moving, I find that really starts me off on the right foot. So that's a bit of a non-negotiable for me. I can obviously do the odd day without it, of course, but if I go like a week or longer without it, I'm cranky. So, you know, I need that'd be one. Non-negotiable is I try and wake up every morning with what I call an attitude of gratitude. So right. I try and think in the morning, and it doesn't have to be big things, right? But like, what am I grateful for this morning? Like my first waking thought, the moment I'm lying in my bed before I've even moved, like, what am I grateful for today? And it could be like, I'm grateful that I'm just lying next to my wife, or I'm grateful that it's sunny outside, or I'm grateful that I've got an opportunity to grow my business today. Whatever it is, right? Mm. But just reinforcing in my brain positive messaging. The other non-negotiable is I don't know where this stems from, but I always have to make sure that we made our bed, so that you get into a made bed in the evening. It's just call it a neurotic behavior, right? But I'm like, I feel like if I get up and I make my bed for the day, I feel like I can't describe it. And people will be like, what an idiot listening to this, right? But it just sets the stall out for me of like, okay, like the first thing I've done is I've shown sort of discipline and rigor in that I've got our bed, I've made it, it's ready, I've set myself up, and I'm ready, I've got everything ready for when I go back to bed in the evening.
I get that as a metaphor for preparation and almost just getting yourself as these three things are. I'm set for the day. And now I've done this, I know I'm set for the day.
Yeah.
And you know, that's small 2 minute routine, if that gives you this, you know, this sense, this value, then you're in a great place. And I get that completely. I'll have to share that with my wife, because I'm not the best at making our bed, to be completely frank and transparent with you. So when she listens to this, she will laugh. Ollie Phillips, well, you know, thank you so much for joining the show today. I just loved, you know, the stories, the honesty that's come through that, and the wisdom in it as well, because there's so much learning in this really interesting career that you've had, and you've sort of woven us through it and what you've got from it. So I really appreciate you coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Rich. I mean, I've got enough gray hairs at 38, so there must be hopefully a tiny bit of wisdom in there. So we love that. But yeah, it's great to be on. Thanks ever so much for having me here. Thanks to everyone for listening.
Wow, what a way to finish a series around sport, and that I've just loved being able to bring to you. From my very first chat with Martin Perry about positivity all the way through to this one, each guest has brought something wonderful, honesty, and shared their stories with us. So watch this space for a series roundup coming soon. But back to this episode. Thank you, Ollie. As I said, what a way to finish. And there's so much to take away from this episode and chew over for anyone, but especially if you are thinking about any kind of career or life change. This goes to show it's not easy, but the rewards can be huge. You know, think about who you might need in your corner to help you make that transition. Friends, colleagues, mentors, maybe even a coach. I loved what Ollie says about life being all about experiences and stories. This is so, so true. And how we share that experience and tell our stories is so much part of who we are. And for someone who's experienced so much success in their life, what success now truly means to him, the shared experiences he's had and how dear he holds those memories, and what he does with what he's learned on each of these incredible adventures and sporting challenges that he's taken on.
Speaking of which, Ollie talks about his latest challenge, which starts in just a few days' time. Ollie's taking part in the Great Rugby Cycle, a full tour of Ireland in support of the My Name is Dodie Foundation, which raises funds for research into motor neurone disease. There's over 1,000 miles of riding ahead of him and the other fundraisers, so please support them if you can via the Just Giving link in the show notes. Okay, I never like ending a series, but I do so clear in the knowledge that this has been a joy to make, and that the Mojo podcast will return with a brand new series in September 2021, with more amazing guests sharing their personal Mojo stories that are always revealing, positive, and inspiring. And if you have a great guest in mind, please do let me know. I'm always looking for those Mojo stories. Okay, until then, I hope your mojo continues to flow.